Welcome to CYC Podcast, episode number 50. I'm Wolfgang Vachon. We have officially changed the name of this show to CYC Podcast. We've done this to better identify what this podcast is about and to make it easier for people to locate us. If everything goes as I hope, you should be able to find us at both cycpodcast.org and c2ypodcast.org, at least until the end of the summer. I encourage you to link, post, tweet, and otherwise pass the podcast on to people you know who work with children and youth or who might be interested in hearing it. For this official transition to CYC Podcast, I'm interviewing one of the more prolific writers and thinkers in child and youth care, Dr. Kiris Garibagi. Dr. Garibagi is co-editor of the journal Child and Youth Services, has a column in CYC Online, regularly contributed to relational child and youth care practice, has written or edited 5 books, and is an associate professor in the School of Child and Youth Care at Ryerson University in Toronto. Welcome, Kiris, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
The catalyst for the interview was your latest book, which you co-edited with Hans Scott Meyer and the late Mark Kruger. The book was called With Children and Youth, Emerging Theories and Practices in Child and Youth Care. What are some of the emerging theories and practices in child and youth care as you understood it or has been identified by the authors?
Well, I should answer that by first telling you a little bit about how this book came about, because there's a story behind that that really speaks to how I see emerging practices in child and youth care as well as the theoretical foundations of those.
Wonderful.
This book really came about after having 2 gatherings, and we purposefully called them gatherings as opposed to conferences or symposiums or workshops, in New Mexico that were organized by Mark Kruger at a slightly run-down retreat facility, which really was a farmhouse with some turkeys running around. And there were about 15 of us or so each time. That included people, obviously, like Mark Kruger and Hans Scott Meyer, myself, Carol Stewart was there, Tom Garfad was at the first one, and Jack Phelan was there as well, and a number of other people. There was a little bit of changeover between the first one and the second one. And what we did at those retreats was start with questions that sounded like we were going to have fairly academic conversations, but that then quickly turned us into the people we actually are and our more raw observations about what we are experiencing in the field of child and youth care. And, the structure, they were 3-day meetings or gatherings, and the structure ranged from sort of very social to fairly focused, sitting in a circle and then going for walks in the mountains of New Mexico and so on, so that it really lent itself to conversations that perhaps wouldn't happen at more formal gatherings. And one of the things after the second time of doing this, at one point Mark, Hans, and I ended up in a conversation about some point that Hans had made that was a very, very sort of profound and very detailed point about Foucault and how that fit with relational practice and so on. And we got into this conversation that questioned everything from scientific approaches to postmodernism to critical theory and so on. And we realized as we were having this conversation that our thoughts were not as as polite as we normally represent them in other types of conversations or gatherings. And as we reflected on that a little bit, we thought, what we need is some kind of way of relaying what we're really thinking without the filters of academic convention and publisher needs and all of those kinds of things, so that we can engender a slightly different conversation about where our field is at, what the practices are, and what the theories are, and so on. And that's really how the book came about. And our instruction to all the contributors was, please don't worry about sort of the typical standards required for peer-reviewed chapters in a book. Please don't be super polite. Please really say the things that you don't think you can say and get published. And you know, as you can see, if you read the book, you realize that some people really took that to heart. Jerry Fuster, for example, in the closing chapter of the book, really took that to heart.
he did indeed.
Yes.
As did several of the other authors.
Absolutely. Doug Magnuson's chapter, mm-hmm. I think, is a particularly hard-hitting one as well. And others were, you know, just sort of maintained a little bit of a position of sort of normalcy in quotation marks. So that's how the book came about, and that's why in this book we talk in fairly hard-hitting ways and fairly critical ways about where we're at as a field. And so, you know, one of the starting conversations at the very first gathering was, as it often is when child and youth care people come together, was sort of a really positive and uplifting and praise-oriented way of saying how great we are. And at some point, somebody, and I won't name names, but it might have been me. You know, how come we never talk about bad practice? Because the reality is, I can say with great confidence that in my experience, sure, I've seen fantastic things, but I've also seen some really bad things. You know, not all practice is good. And even not all practice that focuses on the sort of the centrality of relationships is good. In fact, relationships aren't always good. Bad relationships are usually the reason why we encounter young people in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so that really shifted our discussion a little bit, and we became a little bit less celebratory and a little bit more just real about what happens in our field, both in Canada and the United States, and in all kinds of different settings and contexts, and what sorts of questions we might ask to get at identifying those things, thinking about them, not judging them, but trying to create some foundations for moving in different directions. And so, you know, to answer, that was a really long-winded way of answering your question. To get to the question of, you know, what are the practices and what are the theories? I think the theories are generally much more easily identifiable because we have a written record of them. So we can talk about anything from relational practice to life space intervention, to engagement-focused theories, to children's rights-informed perspectives, but also to evidence-based practices, to more clinically-oriented theories that have a very strong base in things like attachment theory and resilience theory and so on. And that's all fine and good. I mean, I'm not one to present a deep criticism of any of those theoretical frameworks because they all have merit in their own way. The question then becomes, how do you translate any of this into practice? And not just in a way that reflects a sort of a really good transition from theory to practice, but one that takes into account how a young person might actually experience us being with them. And you know, young people generally don't care about theory and don't care about our reasons for doing things. They care more about their moment-to-moment experiences, mm-hmm. which makes a lot of sense from their perspective. And to some extent, it would make a lot of sense if we incorporated that perspective in our own doing as well. And so when it comes to practice, At the very least, I can say that what I see in the field in all settings is incredible variation. That's the first thing. The second thing is that I see a lot of rhetoric about some core concepts that are then applied or used in everyday life in both very positive and very negative ways, and sometimes by the very same person. So relationships, I've seen them used as mechanisms of control, as mechanisms of almost psychological manipulation, as in, hey, I've been good to you, why aren't you doing what I'm asking you to do, to really profound ways of being connected with another person that are free, democratic, and equitable in lots of different ways. And I would say that the same is true with just about every core concept of our field. One, just a quick other story that sort of exemplifies what you know, how I'm seeing the field these days. And
please.
And this is a residential care story, but not long ago I was asked by a residential care provider, a fairly large residential care provider, who was an accredited Transmal Health Agency, to review or to give an opinion about, you know, how they've structured their residential care settings. And to do this, they send me all of their policies and procedures, and also this 60-page booklet that basically put out what they are and what their values are, what their approaches are, and so on. And I read the booklet, 60 pages worth of text. And when I came and met with them, they were very anxious to hear lots of positive feedback, because they had put a lot of work into this, and to their credit, and that in and of itself, I think, is a good thing. But the first thing I had to say to them is, you know, I read your 60 pages of text, and I had to read it two or three times, because it wasn't what I was reading that was concerning me, it was what I think was missing. And so in the end, I actually used my computer to do a word search in your document, and I searched for the word care. It was not in your document. So you write for 60 pages in a residential care and treatment facility about what you are, and you don't use the word care. That's a problem. What does that mean to you? And so to me, this really exemplifies the fundamental problematic in our field. Because it speaks to having a lot of interest in very strong and very complex theoretical formulation, but really never having engaged this process of in applying any of this stuff, in bringing this stuff to the everyday lives of young people. Are we maintaining a focus on how, from their perspective, life ought to unfold? And I think therein there are still many, many problems that to some extent we try to address, and to some extent we actually perpetuate by what I think is a very significant drive in our field right now to be seen as more important, as more effective, as more valued, as more professional, as, you know, all of those things.
And where do you think that drive is coming from?
Well, to be fair, I think it comes from many, many years, decades really, of knowing that we're doing difficult work, knowing that we are often doing work that can be life-altering, sometimes for the worse, but often for the better, and feeling very much isolated in the broader systems that make decisions about how one is to engage with young people facing adversity. So there, you know, it is not untrue that child and youth care practitioners in lots of different settings have been pushed to the margins of the discussion, of the narrative of how to be with young people facing adversity. That's not untrue. But the response to that, I think, has been a deep desire to sound more and be seen more as professionals who are not unlike other professionals who don't have this issue of living on the margins.
And that
can be a problem.
And sorry, what was the last word that you said?
That can be a problem.
Right. Yeah. And it's a problem because why?
Because it is very, very challenging, and I don't think done very well currently. It is very, very challenging to change your position in an interprofessional, multidisciplinary context by primarily trying to conform to the language, the sort of the logic of other approaches to being with young people that are, by the way, incredibly important approaches, but not the only approaches. So that's very difficult without giving up your own foundations.
And so what do you propose to address this tension?
So, I think, you know, one of the great things that child and youth care has done is it really has developed itself based on concepts that on the surface seem very simple. So concepts like relationship, engagement, and caring, which I would suggest are sort of three that lie at the core of everything we do, on the surface are very simple concepts, and we have never abandoned those, in name at least. So we continue to talk about that. If we ask any child and youth care practitioner, you know, what do you do, in some form or another, they would mention these concepts. But I think what we have abandoned is our quest to really continue to focus on developing these concepts in a way that they reflect who we are, who young people are, what the context of our relational engagement is, and so on. So the references in conversations with child and youth care practitioners to relationship are really surface references. They are relationship as if it were an object, and a relatively static object to boot. And I think we are busy teaching practitioners, training practitioners in things like attachment theory and resilience and 40 assets and all of those kinds of things that seem to really lend themselves to be translated into very particular actions, without continuing our focus on, let's first of all really understand as much as we possibly can our core concepts and work with those. I have to honestly say I can imagine many settings where one might have practitioners who work based only on caring relationships and engagement and just do nothing with attachment theory or resilience or whatever, and would probably provide a better context for being with young people than many of the very high-end services that mix and match all kinds of theoretical approaches that sound really complex, but ultimately feature a lot of rhetoric and young people who feel abandoned.
And do you see that possible multi-sectorially? So hospitals, correction facilities, you know, street outreach, shelter system, residential care, group homes, et cetera, et cetera?
Absolutely. And I think, in fact, that it has to be multi-sectoral. And it has to bring into the conversation child and youth care practitioners who are embedded in all these various different ways of being engaged with young people in different contexts. So, you know, we've done, you know, many of our concepts have evolved out of residential care. And I think to move them forward, we now have to really emphasize or really amplify the voices of practitioners who have adopted these concepts not in a residential care context, but in a street outreach context, or in the context of working with newcomers, or in the context of working with the LGBTQ community. Because caring encounters limitations in a residential care context that it may not encounter in a street outreach context. And to get past these limitations, we have to listen to people who are trying to use these concepts differently.
You recently wrote in CYC Online about education, and you argued that the primary purpose, as you saw it, of post-secondary, and I assume you meant undergrad and college education, the primary purpose is development of the person, as opposed to theories and constructs, et cetera, et cetera. Not that you were belittling or dismissing those, but you saw that as the primary purpose. How does development of the self-development of the person fit into the idea of relationship, caring, and engagement as you understand it?
Well, I think, relationships are not knowledge-based things. Caring is not a knowledge-based thing. It's very much an experiential thing in which one brings oneself to the process. And I think it's, you know, I have many students, and I've always had many students, who are straight-A students, who I simply cannot imagine encountering or being engaged with some of the young people who I know are living in the various contexts of the youth-serving systems. Just being good at articulating things is not enough. Ultimately, relational practice can't unfold outside of the context of a really strong engagement with self. I think the other observation I will make is that in our child and youth care program at Ryerson University, we accept or admit students either straight out of high school, but also out of 3 years of college education. And I know that the curriculum in colleges is very good. It's very good in the sense that there is a lot of material that is being taught, material related to child development, material related to theories of change, and so on. When they enter our program, it's like that never happened. It's really like that never happened. You know, any reference to any sort of theoretical framework or whatever just is greeted with blank faces. And so what that speaks to, I think, is that, first of all, a deeply entrenched culture of performing for the great reward. Mm-hmm. That is one issue. So there is a difference between achieving grades and learning something.
Say it isn't so, Kiris. Say it isn't so.
Sorry, I hate to say it. But I think that it really is uncanny just how little of the knowledge base is retained and developed as more knowledge is taught. And I think when it then comes to challenging students, for example, in one of my classes, I do this thing where I say to students, listen, what do you think is the worst thing that could possibly happen in your life, short of your own death? And invariably, the response to that question are things like, you know, my child dies, or my mother dies, or, you know, my closest friend moves to Australia, or something like that. And what all those answers usually have in common is that it's about loss of relationship in some form or shape. And then I say to them, so when you encounter a young person in your work, you know ahead of time that you're not going to be with them forever. You're going to offer relationship, and then you will withdraw relationship, maybe because you get a new job, maybe because a young person is discharged, but you know all of this ahead of time. So in effect, what you're doing is you are setting up the young person to experience what you yourself identify as being the worst thing that could possibly happen in your life. And you know all of this ahead of time. What kind of an insane and sadistic profession would base its entire essence on the concept of relationship? Isn't that terrible? So, you know, I throw this at fourth-year students, by the way. So these are people who have studied extensively in the field of child and youth care. And they can't answer it. They are stumped. They, you know, I say to them, so everything you've ever learned about relationship, you need to forget, because clearly it's not the right thing to do. And they have no way of defending their own profession, the essence of their profession, the most central concept in all of the writing in child and youth care. They can't defend it. And to me, that really speaks to, while knowledge may have progressed somewhat while they're in their studies, they know a few more theories, they know a few more of this and that, really, the incorporation of ideas into how we see ourselves doesn't happen as much as it needs to. Because if you did, you could defend relational practice, no problem.
So can I flip the tables and ask you to defend relational practice then, Kiris?
Okay. I'm going to take the fifth on that one.
So all the students who future come into your class don't have the answer already pat for you.
Yeah, there you go.
Fair enough.
Well, I think what's, you know, when we debrief this particular conversation and this particular exercise, you know, we talk about the important, you know, the assumption that my scenario makes is that when we're no longer physically together in our service context, because a young person was discharged or we moved to Vancouver or whatever it might be, does that actually mean that the relationship has ended? And we talk about, you know, I ask students, you know, have you lost someone who's been important in your life? You know, often a grandparent or whatever. Does this person no longer exist for you? Is your relationship with this person really over, as if it never happened? Or is there something about that relationship that actually continues, that in spite of our physical separation? And that's the beginning of sort of turning relationship away from being an object and a knowledge-based process to, oh yeah, this really is about me. It's about how I remember things. It's about how I internalize things. It's about how being with somebody or even thinking about someone shapes me in my everyday moments, in my reflections, in my imagination, and so on. And I think we just need a lot more of that, especially to guard against, going back to your question about practice, to guard against what inevitably is an experience that especially new practitioners have, which is no matter what they have learned in school, this will largely be erased by whatever organizational culture they encounter in their place of employment. So, you know, by far the greater driving force of what we think we're supposed to do is organizational culture, not post-secondary education. Unless we find ways of helping people or equipping people to not lose themselves in the commands of whatever organizational culture is.
So the extension of your argument, and please stop me if I'm misinterpreting, the extension of your argument, as I understand it, is CYC practitioners have, you know, need to be aware of self, have some sort of foundational core. The organization they work in is going to greatly influence their practice, and understanding self and who one is and understanding relationship is what's going to keep them as a CYC practitioner, regardless of the organizational pressures. Even if there's a 60-page document which never once mentions care, that individual is going to find opportunities to care in that facility. Is there then a purpose other than creating theory of education? And I don't mean that flippantly, I mean that genuinely. There's been lots of talk over the years around child and youth care, around professionalization, around accreditation, around certifying child and youth care practitioners. And I've heard many people say, you know, it's about an essence, about who you are. And I've struggled with that. And I thought, well, yes, I part of me agrees that. And part of me thinks, well, how do you hire for essence? And what I'm hearing you say, though, to greater and lesser extent, is in some ways that is true, that the education in and of itself is maybe not the primary thing, but it's about who the individual is coming into the school.
Well, I don't want to. So I was with you until the very end there. I don't want to suggest, and in fact, I categorically reject an argument that suggests that it's predetermined. That is to say, you know, by the time you're 18 or 19 and you enter post-secondary education, it's already clear whether you are going to be a good practitioner or not. That's because I don't think that's true. And I think that would really be a downer for all of us involved in post-secondary education.
At least clear limiting.
Yes. So I really reject that kind of an argument. What I will say is that there has in pedagogic theory, there has for centuries really been a distinction drawn between teaching and learning. You know, these are not the same things. And I think our current approach has increasingly moved to valuing teaching, that is the process by which experts impart upon non-experts knowledge, as opposed to the process of learning. That is the way in which people absorb new ideas, perspectives, ways of seeing the world into who they are. And this, I think, is a problematic piece where we have a large role to play as educators, as people involved in post-secondary education. I'm not against post-secondary education in child and youth care practice. Quite to the contrary, I'm absolutely in favor of it. But I think we have to, where we can, we have to challenge systems that try to render child and youth care education similar to chemistry education. Because I don't think the task is the same. I don't think what we are preparing people to do is the same. And I note that, by the way, even in chemistry, in the history of science more generally, those who really had a significant impact were often people who did not conform even then to the education standards of their time. So even in disciplines where it's not obvious that there is a relational context, that there is a more imaginative context than just the absorption of knowledge, it turns out that it's those who focused on learning rather than on being taught that made a much more significant difference. Okay? So you know, Galileo was somebody who didn't just have good scientific ideas, but who challenged major systems. The same is true for Copernicus. The same is true for Tycho Brahe. You know, these are the people who gave us our understanding of the universe by challenging sort of the ground assumptions of what is real and what isn't. And I think in child and youth care, this has to happen too. The goal, by the way, is not just for practitioners to do child and youth care in spite of organizational culture. The goal is for child and youth care practitioners to become one element in shaping organizational culture. This sort of goes back to, you know, James Anglin's work around congruence in service delivery and so on. And child and youth care practitioners have to play a role in that.
I was, you know, coming to the end of this semester, it's April as we do this podcast, I come at the end of the semester and there was a student that I was struggling with because they would often raise things in class that, you know, just I didn't agree with it. I thought it was, you know, philosophically I disagree with it. It was a very different approach. It was much more punitive. It was, you know, in many ways things that I didn't agree with. And I found myself getting increasingly less and less compassionate with this student. And when I came to the end of With Children and Youth, I heard so strongly in the book the need for voices of dissent. I heard really, really clearly how important it is to challenge the orthodoxy, if I can use that term, to challenge the dominant paradigms, to question what it is. And this past week I went to that student and I thanked them, and I said, I pulled them aside and I said, I really appreciate your contributions to this class, because you say lots of things that I struggle with and that are hard for me to hear and that I don't agree with, and I think that voice is crucial, because you're speaking in a way that brings dissenting voices to this classroom, and I want to appreciate that. And I think what With Children and Youth Do, the book that you co-edited, is you give us a bit of a model for that, and you remind us how important that dissent is, as you do with a great deal of your writing, which I find myself constantly returning to. So as we end this conversation, I want to say thank you for having those, you know, not so polite conversations in New Mexico and turning that into what I thought was a very polite conversation with me.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad it came like that. That's excellent.
Thank you very much. I will be doing a review of this book for the next issue of Relational Child and Youth Care Practice. So I encourage everyone who wants my additional opinions on the book to pick that up. And I want to thank you, Kiris, for all the work you do and the writing and the reading and the thinking and the continuing to publish, and for talking with me today.
Thank you. And thank you also to you for making this kind of a way of thinking about child and youth care possible. I think these podcasts are absolutely amazing.
Wonderful. Thanks a lot.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast.
Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher.
Visit us online at cycpodcast.org.